The oxen caught the whiff of lion as he moved into the wind, and he heard them coming up, rising in that awkward plunging leap from which they had settled. Horns clashed together as they swung into a tight group facing upwind, and one of them let out a soft, mournful lowing. Immediately it was taken up, and their low bellows woke the men at the fires. Somebody shouted and threw a log on the fire. A torrent of sparks rose in the dark branches of the mimosa, and the log caught, lighting the camp with a yellow, leaping, dancing light. The ploughmen and the lead boys were gathered fearfully around the fire, still with skin karosses draped around their shoulders, owl-eyed with sleep and alarm. The lion slipped like a shadow, dark and flat, against the earth towards the kraal, and the cattle bunched and bellowed wildly at the sharp, rank cat smell. Against the thorny windward side of the kraal, the lion crouched, arched his back, and ejected a stream of urine. The pungent, biting, ammoniac stink was too much for the mass of cattle. In a single solid bunch, they swung away downwind and charged the thorny wall of the temporary kraal, crashing through it without check, and they thundered free, quickly spreading, losing the solid formation and scattering away into the night. The lioness was ready for them, and she streaked in across the flank of the panicking, plunging formation, selecting a single victim, a heavy young beast. She drove him onwards, chivying him like a sheepdog, crossing and recrossing his frantic driving quarters, running him far from the fires and the ploughmen, before coming snaking up alongside and hooking expertly at one of his powerful driving forelegs, and the curved yellow claws biting in just above the hock until they grated against the bone. Then she went back on her bunched quarters and dragged the leg to cross the other. The ox dropped as though he'd been shot through the brain, and he somersaulted haunch over head and slid against the earth on his back, all four legs kicking to the starry sky. In a rubbery flash of supple speed, the cat closed, judging finally the mass of hooves that could have crushed her skull and the wide straight horns which could have impaled her rib to rib. She bit in hard at the base of the skull, driving the long ivory yellow eye teeth into the first and second vertebra, so they crunched sharply like a walnut in the jaws of the cracker. When the lion came padding hurriedly out of the night, she had already opened the belly cavity of the ox, and her whole head was red and toffee-sticky with blood as she went for liver and spleen and kidneys. She flattened her ears against her bloody skull and snarled murderously at him. But he put his shoulder to her flank and pushed her aside. She snarled again, and he cuffed her with a lordly paw and began to feed in the hole she had made. She glared at him for a second, and then her ears came erect, and she began to lick his shoulder with long, pink, voluptuous strokes, purring with a deep, soft rattle in her throat, pressing her long, sleek body against him. The lion tried to ignore her, and fed with snuffling grunts and wet, tearing, ripping sounds. But she became bolder, the eternal female taking advantage of her new, highly attractive condition. Liberties which before would have brought swift and stern disciplinary action. Desperately, the lion tried to restrain her by placing a huge paw on her head. Claws carefully retracted, and gulped furiously, trying to eat the entire ox before she could join in. But she wriggled out from under the paw and licked his ear. He growled half-heartedly, flickered the ear. She inched forward, and licking his eyes, so he had to close them tightly, furrowing his brow and trying to feed blind. But finally he surrendered to the inevitable and allowed her to force her head into the bloody crater. Side by side, purring and growling softly, they fed. There were 18 of them, gathered on the wide mosquito-screened veranda of the foreman's cottage under the hissing Petromax lamps. The brandy bottle had been out since sundown, and most of the men were red-faced and bright-eyed as they listened to Dirk Courtney. "There'll be schools and hospitals within a 20-mile ride of everybody," he promised, and the woman looked up from their knitting. They knew what it was like to raise a young family out here. "This is only the beginning," he promised the men, "and those of you who were first in will be the first to profit. Once I am in Parliament, you will have a strong voice speaking up for you. You will see improvement here you couldn't imagine possible. And quickly." "You're a rich man, Mr. Courtney," one of them said. He was a small trader, not directly employed by Lady Bergsugar, but sufficiently reliant on it to phrase his question with respect. "One of the bosses. How come you speak out for the working man?" "I'm rich because I work hard, but I know that without you men I won't be rich much longer. We are linked together like a team." They nodded and murmured, and Dirk went on quickly. "One thing I promise you, when I can hire a white man at a decent wage, I won't push in coolie or nigger labour." They cheered him then, and filled their glasses to toast him. "Your present government, the Smuts men, tried that on the gold mines. 2 and 2 pence a day for black men and white men out on the street. When the workers protested, they sent the bloody butcher of Fordsburg, a man who I am ashamed to call my father." There was an urgent hammering on the kitchen door, and the foreman excused himself quietly and hurried out. He was back within a minute, and whispered to Dirk Courtney. Dirk grinned and nodded, and turned back to his audience. "Well, gentlemen, fine bit of sport in the offing. A lion has killed one of my oxen, down on the new Bewley block. The ploughboy has just come in to report it. It happened only an hour ago, so we will have an excellent sporting chance at him. May I move closure of this meeting, and we'll meet here again at, he glanced at his watch, at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Every man with a horse and rifle." Mark and Pungushi slept, each under a single blanket, on the sun-baked earth, with Trojan cropping the scraggy, dry yellow grass nearby. There was a cold little breeze out of the east, and they woke in the total dark of not yet dawn, and sat over the fire drinking coffee and smoking silently until Pungushi could take the spoor again. From the back of Trojan it was still too dark to see the ground, but Pungushi ran confidently ahead, forcing the mule into a reluctant lumbering trot to keep pace. At the edge of the ploughed land he had to cast, but he cut the lion's spoor on its new track almost immediately. They went off again, with the sunrise outlining the upper branches of the trees, turning them black and spiky against the ruddy gold. The soft amber rays were without warmth, and threw long distorted shadows of mule and men on the hard red earth. Mark marvelled once again that the Zulu could run a spoor in this light over such ground, where he could see no mark or sign of the lion's passing. There was a single gunshot, so faint that Mark thought he might have imagined it, but Pungushi stopped instantly and signalled him to rein in the mule. They stood and listened intently, and suddenly there was a distant popping fusillade, 10, 11 rifle shots, and then silence again. Pungushi turned and looked at Mark expressionlessly. The silence was complete. Even the morning bird chorus was stilled by the gunfire for a moment. Then, as the silence persisted, a troop of little brown francolin started chirping again on the edge of the ploughed fields. "Go on," Mark nodded to Pungushi, trying to keep his face as expressionless. But his voice shook with outrage. They were too late. The last lions south of the Usutu were dead. He felt sick with helpless anger. They did not notice Mark until he was right up to them. They were too excited, too intent on their work. There were 8 white men, all heavily armed and dressed in rough hunting clothes, with 2 Zulu grooms holding the horses. In a trampled opening among the mimosa trees lay the half-eaten carcass of a red and white ox. However, this was not what was engaging their attention. They were grouped in a tight circle beyond the ox, and their voices were raucous, raised in rough jest and cheerful oath. Mark dismounted and handed the reins to Pungushi. He walked slowly towards the group, dreading what he would find, but he stopped again as one of the men looked up and saw him. He recognised Mark instantly. "Ah, Warden," Dirk Courtney laughed, tossing that splendid head of glossy curls. "We're doing your job for you." The laughter was sly and spiteful, the malice so apparent that Mark knew he was thinking of the bribe that Mark had accepted and then turned against him. "Here is one that you can cross off your report," Dirk chuckled again, and gestured for his men to stand aside. The circle opened, and Mark stepped into the opening. The men around him were still red-faced and garrulous, and he could smell the stale liquor on them. "Gentlemen, may I present the newly appointed warden of Charker's Gate proclaimed area?" Dirk stood opposite him, across the circle, with one hand thrust carelessly into the pocket of his chamois leather jacket, a handmade double-barreled .450 elephant rifle by Gibbs of London, tucked into the crook of his elbow. The lion lay on its side with all 4 legs extended, He was an old scarred Tom, so lean and rangy that each rib showed clearly through the short tan hair. There were four bullet holes in the body. The one behind the shoulder would have raked both lungs, but another heavy bullet had shattered the skull. The mouth hung open slackly, and a little blood-stained saliva still oozed out onto the lolling pink tongue. "Congratulations, gentlemen," Mark nodded, and only Dirk Courtney caught the irony in his voice. "Yes," he agreed. "The sooner we clear this area and make it safe for settlement, the better for all." There was a hearty chorus of agreement, and one of them produced a brown bottle from his back pocket and passed it from hand to hand, each in turn pointing its base, briefly heavenwards, then exclaiming appreciatively and smacking their lips. "What about the lioness?" Mark asked quietly, refusing his turn at the bottle. "Oh, don't worry about her," one of them assured him. "She's down already. I hit her clean in the shoulder. We're just giving her a chance to stiffen up before we go after her to finish her off." And he drew his sheath knife and began to skin out the carcass of the lion, while the comrades passed loud comment and advice. Mark walked back to Pungushi, who squatted patiently at Trojan's head. "The lioness is wounded, but has run." "I have seen her this spoor," Pungushi nodded, and pointed it out with his eyes, not moving his head. "How bad is she hit?"
"I do not know yet. I must see how she settles to run before judging."
"Take the spoor," said Mark. "Let us go quietly, without alerting these mighty hunters." They drifted away from the clearing, leading the mule casually, Mark following a dozen paces behind the Zulu. 500 yards further on, Pungushi stopped and spoke quietly.
"She is hit in the right shoulder or leg, but I do not think the bone has gone, for she touches with every second pace. She goes well on three legs, and at first there was a little blood, but it dries quickly."
"Perhaps she bleeds inside?" Mark asked.
"If that is so, we will find her within a short while dead," Pungushi shrugged.
"All right," Mark swung up onto the saddle. "Let us go swiftly, that we may outrun these others. None of them will be able to follow across such hard ground." It was too late. "Anders," Dirk Courtney shouted, riding up at the head of his band. "What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"My job," Mark answered. "I'm following a wounded beast."
"We're coming with you."
Mark glanced at Pungushi, and a silent accord flashed between them. Then he turned back to the group.
"You all realize the danger involved. These animals have probably been hunted before, and my tracker thinks the lioness is only lightly hit."
There was a little sobering and hesitation, but all eight of them rode on after Pungushi. He went hard, loping away, Minsa Amklabati, stretching the horses into an easy canter, and after the first hour, Dirk Courtney swore bad-temperedly.
"I don't see any blood."
"The blood is dried," Mark told him. "The wound is closed."
The contents of the brown bottle were long ago exhausted. Red faces were sweating heavily in the rising heat. Eyes were bloodshot, and high good humour turning to headaches and woolly tongues. None of them had remembered to bring a water bottle. Two of them turned back. An hour later, Dirk Courtney snarled suspiciously. "This bloody nigger is giving us a bum run. Tell him I'll take the horsewhip to him."
"The lioness is going strongly."
"I don't believe it. I can't see any spoor."
Pungushi stopped abruptly, motioned them to stay, and went forward cautiously into a low thicket of Vatabesi scrub.
"Oh, I've had a gutsful of this," muttered one of the hunters miserably. "Me too. I've got work to do."
Three more of them turned back, and those that remained sat their restless horses until Pungushi emerged from the thicket and beckoned them forward. In the heart of the thicket, impressed deeply into the soft mound of a mole heap, he showed them the unmistakable pad of a lioness. It headed relentlessly southward.
"All right," Dirk Courtney acknowledged. "He's still on the spoor. Tell him to keep going."
An hour after noon, the lioness led them onto a low, unbroken cap of solid grey granite, and Pungushi sat down wearily. His muscles shone in the sunlight with sweat, as though they had been oiled. He looked up at Mark on the mule and shrugged with an expressive gesture of helplessness.
"Dead spoor," said Mark. "Gone away."
Dirk Courtney pulled up his horse's head with a cruel jerk of the curb and snapped at Mark. "Anders, I want to speak to you." He trotted away out of earshot of the group, and Mark followed him. They stopped and faced each other, and Dirk's mouth was twisted into a pinched and bitter line. "This is the second time you've been clever at my expense," he started grimly. "You could have had me as an ally, but instead you had my father sent me a receipt for my gift. Now you and your savage have pulled another trick. I don't know how you did it, but it's the last time it'll happen." He stared at Mark, and the slant of the eyes altered. Once again that mad, malevolent light burned in their depths.